Excision number 22352, reel 2.
Graham Swain, reel 2.
Because of the nature of the ground in the mountains, it's impossible to dig in into slick trenches. So you build up yourself a shelter, which was called a sanger, of bits of rock and rubble, and there are generally two men to each sanger. And of course, we took over, and I can't remember from the at this stage, which regiment it was, but we were told that's your arc of fire, and they in the darkness, as near as you could say, well, that's the area that you're responsible for, and that's where if they come, you've got to stop them. You know, cheerio, mate, best of luck. And they hop over, and we hopped in. And of course, we just were bedded down in there, and there was no, on the first night, there was no counter attack by the Germans, so we had a bit of a soft introduction. But then, of course, came daylight, when you absolutely had to keep your head down, and we could then actually see what we were supposed to be, the bit that we were supposed to be looking after, and the next hangar would be 10-15 yards away. Well, the second night we were there, the Germans sent out a fighting patrol, and a fighting patrol has one object, and that's to take prisoners, and it comes out in quite strength. But we heard them sculling around, coming towards us, and we let off a few rounds. First time I'd actually ever fired my rifle in anger, and it was at a noise. So I don't know if I hit anybody or not, but the noise ceased. And the other thing, of course, which is so pungent at night time, the smell of cigarette smoke. The smell of a cigarette travels for miles. And you could smell this sickly German tobacco that these blokes were. Quite unheard of. You never smoked on a fighting patrol. We didn't anyway. And it could smell this sickly stuff. Anyhow, they didn't advance onto our positions, and in fact, we held on. Well, we were there for about, of course, you're stuck in this thing all day, and if you poke your head up, you're likely to get a sniper from one of the other side taking a pop shot at you. Of course, the problem is the toilet. So during the day, you can't go. You can have a pee, but you can't do the other thing. And of course, at night, you have to hop over the wall and, you know, bloody awful. And of course, at night, they used to bring up hot food from B Echelon by carrying parties. And it would be a tin of soup, a hot soup in a Dixie or something like that. This is actually in the front line. We get this hot food, not always, but when you were in a sort of static position like that, you've got it.
Were troops supplied with toilet paper?
Say again?
Were troops supplied with toilet paper?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, bump. Yes. Bumps, you did. That's one thing they did. They were the. Somebody did think about it, because when you were actually in the line fighting, you got. During that period, a 50 tin of cigarettes issued free, because they thought that it had a great, you know, didn't kill you like it's supposed to now. It kept you going, no doubt about it. And I'd never smoked before I went into the army, but I did start to smoke then, and I kept it up for a long while afterwards. Yes, toilet paper and soap, and I forget whether you got razor blades free. I think you did get razor blades free, and the 50 tin of cigarette. Oh, and occasionally a bar of chocolate. We all had a block of hardtack chocolate, which was an emergency ration, which you were not allowed to use unless you were ordered so to do. And that was a thick black chocolate which broke your teeth when you did finally eat it. But they did think about us in that regard. And we were up there, I suppose, for about 4 or 5 nights. Well, then we were relieved in exactly the same fashion as we'd gone in. So, well, there you are, that's mate, that's where you go, that's what you got, and we're off. And you go down the hill, back to battalion headquarters, but for resting, you see. But then you'd be then back up again that night as part of the carrying party, bringing up the grub, you know. So you weren't, you know, weren't resting at all.
Was it possible under those circumstances to do anything to make yourself a bit more comfortable?
Well, no. You had just your gear. When you went into the line, you had called FSMO, fighting something. It was a small pack with your pouches, your brain gun, your respirator, your gas cape, which was it's not plastic, but what would be the forerunner of plastic, a gas cape, which was upon which the rivulets of mustard gas are supposed to roll off, you see. It was waterproof, but you were strictly forbidden to use it as a waterproof. The British Army had a cape. It was called a gas cape, but you also had a waterproof cape, which used not to keep the rain out. So most people, towards the end of the campaign, and they turned a blind eye to it, used to use their gas capes as a waterproof. But I think forget if we had a blanket or not. And your greatcoat, and your shovel or your entrenching tool. Most of us had shovels.
Was there any German shelling or mortaring?
Oh, constantly. I mean, every now and then. Germans sort of had a fixed routine. Oh, it's 4 o'clock. Let's give them a few bombs, and up would come the light mortars, not the Nebelwerfers. I don't know if you heard of the expression Nebelwerfers. They were deadly things, but they were used more in open country rather than in the confined. It's job, unless you actually know the mountains of Italy, you think, well, how the hell do we even get there, let alone fight for it and repel people? I mean, because every block of rock was a possibility of somebody hiding behind. It was the most ideal defence country in the world. I mean, how the hell we ever get the way we did is remarkable. And of course, the problem was supplies. Of course, you couldn't get jeeps or anything up to where we were, and it was all mules. And I'll say this, a lot of Indians were muleteers, and everything was brought up, ammunition, water, of course.
Do you remember who this comrade was with whom you shared the?
I cannot remember. I cannot remember his name. Later on, it was my first action. I mean, I'd only just gone into the battalion. I didn't know anybody at that time.
Which company and platoon were you in at this time?
13 platoon, which is ominous. C Company. That was the 7th Battalion Ochsenbachs.
Were you superstitious?
Yes, well, I like everybody, 13, oh, that's bloody unlucky, but yeah, it didn't make a damn difference, did it? And I became a fatalist. At the end of the war, I thought, if my number's up, it's going to come. And I'm afraid majority of infantrymen were like that, because I've seen some heartbreak. There was I was so young in those days, and my great friend in the Ochsenbachs, he's now dead, was Corporal Curly Collett, and he was over 30 then to my 19, and he had been a groundsman at Magdalen College in Oxford, cricket groundsman and that sort of thing, and he was like a father to me, and he used to say, and we had some terrible experiences together sometimes, and he always used to call me matey, but he was a corporal, and he had a great friend called George Newman, who had been a carpenter in Civvy Street, and this little incident strikes at me. George Newman was a lovely fella, family man, children, that sort of thing. And I used to smoke a pipe in those days, and somehow I broke it. You know where the stem goes into the bowl? It snapped off. And George said to me, I'll do that for you. And with a pocket knife, he cut a groove round and made an insert for the stem. And he gave me back that pipe, and the next day he was killed. And I thought, God, decent bloke like that.
So you've described to me your first 5 days in the line.
You're in the line, yes.
In this slit yes. trench. Yeah. Do you remember what happened next?
Well, yes, we then came out of the line for, as we called, rest and recuperation. But I mean, you were in front of the artillery anyway. You weren't really resting. And then there was a succession of, we just leapfrogged up, forward, forward, until we got to the River Garigliano, which is one of the high battle points. And we crossed the Garigliano in the night in floating... What's a map? Just...
Books?
Canvas. Collapsible dinghy things, yeah, yeah. Six or seven of us. There was a heavy stonk, and the company that I went across were fortunate to get across without being shot to pieces, because they were on the other side, in the dark, of course, and without overturning and all that. And we managed to hold this riverbank until they got a Bailey Bridge across and reinforced. Paddled across.
Was it a big river?
Oh, Grigliano. Well, all the rivers in Italy, they start off, but of course when you get near the where they enter the sea, they're so wide, I mean, they can be as much as a quarter of a mile wide. Not always in depth, but you've got the water there, you see. And there were a number of them, the Grigliano and the Volturno and the Minturno, all up on the left-hand side going up, all took a lot of casualties getting across.
And once you got across the Garigliano?
The Garigliano, well, then the Anzio bridgehead had just been formed. If you recall, the Allies were held up at Cassino, and the plan was that we would skirt round them just south of Rome, land at Anzio, cut across, and completely cut off the Germans from Cassino. I don't know if you're familiar with the history of the Anzio campaign, where it was a right cock-up, because General Mark Clark, the American Fifth Army general, chose to disobey the orders that Field Marshal Alexander had given him. And it was partly because he landed at Anzio on Peter Beach, completely unopposed, and this has been filmed in recent times, some people actually got into Rome in a jeep and returned, and they said, there's no opposition at all if you go now. But the General Lucas, who was the American commander, called Corncob Lucas, he used to smoke a corncob pipe, was so worried about what had happened at Salerno, where we'd nearly got thrown back into the sea, that he said, I'm going to build up the strength here before I do anything. And of course, it was fatal, because while we were building up, so were the Germans. And in fact, by the time we'd got sufficient men and material there, we were surrounded by a ring of steel. I'm going to describe. And Churchill had said, because he was so frustrated by this, and it's recorded in his diaries and things, there are more chauffeurs on the Anzio bridgehead than there are in London, sort of thing. There are 18,000 vehicles on this Anzio, but we couldn't break out.
Did you land on Peter Beach?
No, I didn't. No, we were at that time on the Garigliano, and we were brought back to a place called Paluzzi, where we embarked on tank infantry landing craft, and we then came round and landed in Nettuno town on the beach there. By that time, of course, this was about a week after the actual main landings, and by that time they were in dead trouble. They were twice almost got to the sea and pushed us back.
So where did you first go into action in the Anzio?
We got off the boat and straight up the Via Anziati into an area which is called the Wadis, well known. Because at the moment of our arriving, the Germans had started their first counterattack. And so we went straight into these wadis, slit trenches, and, well, they weren't slit trenches, they were just scoops in the ground. Given an area, once again, to look at and shoot at. And funnily enough, I just remember this fellow's name, Voisey. He should never have been in the infantry. He wasn't queer, but he was a bit effeminate. And he wore thick pebble glasses. His eyesight was appalling. And he's in this, we're all in these wadis, and he's pooping away in the dark, once again, firing at noise. You can't see anything. And in the morning, there were quite a few bodies there. And in front of Voisey, who couldn't see a thing, there were more bodies than anybody else. Whether he'd shot them or not, I don't know. Of course, some were still alive, and up went the old white flag. And there was this bit of camaraderie in those days of allowing the wounded to be recovered. And all our wounded were behind us, not in front of us, because they were attacking, you see. And that went on for 3 nights, where they tried to push us back, and we did manage to hold. So if you say to me, have I shot anybody? Yes, I must have done. But I in all my service as an infantryman, I never actually killed a man knowing that I was killing him. I fired at noises, you know.
What opinion did you form of the German enemy at Anzio?
Well, we were up against the 90th Light Division, and it was a strange thing. Wherever I was in the 56th London Division, the famous Black Cats, I don't know if that's ever been mentioned to you, our divisional sign was Dick Whittington's Black Cat. And whenever we went into the line, it always seemed we were opposed by this German 90th Light Division. And then we would come out and rest, and they would go out and rest, and we always met them again. And there was always a parachute regiment, which I don't remember the number of, and the name of. They were always there. And they, the German paratroopers were fearless. We didn't respect them. We just, they were there. If the paras, oh Christ, they're there, we're in trouble. And there was an incident after I'd got been in action with the infantry when we first landed at Anzio. For some reason, they required a dispatch rider in the signal platoon. And I was transferred out of the rifle company into the signal platoon, which didn't make a row of beans difference on Anzio, because, as you know, the total depth of the whole bridgehead was only 12 miles, tapering back to zero. And wherever you were, who you were, if you were a cook, you were a padre, wherever you were under constant shell fire. Nobody, no matter how high and mighty you were, escaped the shelling. So whether you were a dispatch rider or a rifleman didn't make a lot of difference. But I was posted as a dispatch rider to the signal platoon. And there I met my first great friend in the army, who only died last year, Eric Catton, who was also a motorcyclist, but he happened to be the commanding officer's dispatch rider. And we've been up there about a month. We were both ordered to go forward to try to establish contact with the forward companies, because radio communication had broken down. And I expect you've heard many times that infantry communication by radio was pretty parlous. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. There was no communication with the forward companies at all, and the CO wanted to know what was happening. So Captain and I go off up this Via Anzioteca, which is a dead straight road, and it's goes to the town of Campoleone. And of course, it was constantly shell fired all the time. We're up this road on our matchless motorbikes, and all of a sudden, one hell of a stonk comes down, shelling. So we decide we better get off and go into a house, which we did. Left the motorbikes outside and go into this house for the shelling to stop. And all of a sudden, almighty crump, the house was hit. And we were buried under the rubble. This is where I caught this. Eric was not...
That's your hearing.
This is my hearing. That's the start of my hearing problem. Because I was totally deaf for about a week with nothing coming through at all. And we realised that we're trapped in this house. And how are we going to get out? Well, then we then hear voices. And there was obviously somebody realised that there was somebody in there. And we hear people, the sound of people pulling the rubble off. And Catton said to me, and I never forget this, his face, he says, bloody hell, I looked up and there's this bleeding great German paratrooper looking at me. And he said, I thought, oh God, we've had it. We're in the bag. But wasn't so. The paratrooper himself was a prisoner and was being escorted back when this happened, and the people who were bringing it back realised we were in there, and they say, oh, go and get me. And they actually pulled the rubble off us, off the motorbikes and that, to get us out. We sent down the regimental aid post, cuts and bruises and that sort of thing. Same thing in this business. So we never did get up to the forward company.
Any other incidents you can describe that happened to you in the bridgehead?
In the bridgehead, yeah.
Either as a rifleman or as a dispatcher?
No, nothing that really caused... Well, we were just there, we were fighting, we were doing our job. Funny things stick in your mind about the bridgehead was that there was a mobile bath unit there. Which was scooped out of earth by bulldozers, like a big, long shallow, and they erected this mobile shower. No cover or anything. And you'd go in one end, dump your clothes, and they'd all be deloused, and you'd come out the other end, all highly clean and shiny, and pick your gear up at the other end. Well, that was... quite something to get yourself clean, because up at the front it was difficult. Stay clean.
Was there much fear in the bridgehead?
Much?
Fear?
Fear? No. The majority of blokes hide their fear. They don't want to let themselves down in front of people. Yes, there were one or two blokes that went over the top, and we used to call them bomb happy. And these days, of course, they'd get counselled and all this sort of thing. But far too much has been made of this necessity to counsel people because they've had a traumatic experience. I mean, going back many, many years ahead, when I was a police constable in Southampton, there was a favourite spot where people used to commit suicide on a railway line. You know, they'd had enough. And we would go down there, and without any exaggeration at all, with a wheelbarrow and pick, and it happened on more than one occasion, pick bits of bodies up in the wheelbarrow and say, oh, poor sod, and the undertaker would come and take him away. We'd go back to the police station and sit down at 2 o'clock in the morning and have our eggs and bacon. And didn't think about it. If you had thought about it, you could have thought what you know. And we didn't require counselling. We joked about it. And that's how we got over it. And all this business now is, you know, you've seen the dead body, so you have to go and be counselled. Oh, bloody hell.
So how long do you think you were in the bridgehead for?
We were there until April, when they decided that they were going to push out. But the division was so decimated by that time, the 56 London Division, that it had to be withdrawn. The casualty rate was very high. I can't remember exactly, but the battalion strength is normally 600. And the oxen bucks who went onto the bridgehead, who actually came out of it, there was less than 100. A lot were taken prisoner. I'm not saying they were killed, but that was, you know, 5/6 of the battalion, and all the other battalions. There was there were 3 battalions of the Queen's Regiment. There was the Royal Fusiliers. There was ourselves, the Oxen Bucks, and the Welch Regiment, I think, or 2 battalions of the Fusiliers. They were all similarly decimated by either by wounding, injuries, or taken prisoner.
What did you think of the leadership in the battalion, the officers and the NCOs?
Our particular commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel M.E.M. MacWilliams. By 3 DSOs, I think he finished up with, and M.C. and Barr, and he had no fear at all. And he expected everybody else to have no fear with him, and he led from the front. And we had a great deal of respect for him. But we thought he's as mad as a bloody March hare. And if there's anything nasty going, we'd volunteer for it.
Did he survive Anzio?
Yes, he did. He died. He lived at Colchester, actually. And he died. In fact, he stayed on in the army. Became a brigadier. And he used to come to our regiment a reunion. We still meet. I'm jumping ahead again because... at a later stage, the Oxen Bucks, of which I was a member, was disbanded, and I was posted to the Queen's Regiment. That's where I did the two main fightings, in the Queen's and the Oxen Bucks. And MacWilliams was a Queen's man, and we meet still every year in the Ebury Arms in Pimlico on the 29th of March, or the nearest date to it, for a lunch. And this last time, 60 of us there, which was good. And MacWilliams was there, he used to come until he died, you know.
So, what happened to you next?
The whole division was withdrawn and we were sent to Egypt. Because by that time there were more and more, the war in the desert, of course, was over. And we were there in Egypt with leave in Cairo, which I remember quite well. And I was also, whilst there, I was sent to because I'd been transferred to the signal platoon, I had to become a classified signaller, so I was sent to a signal school. And I also collared dysentery and malaria. And I was in the 19th General Hospital on the Great Bitter Lake for a month, you know.
Did you get the dysentery and malaria in Egypt?
In Egypt. I picked it up in Egypt, yeah.
How do you think that happened?
Oh, in sanitary conditions, really. I mean, the desert, flies, food, and sort of thing. Almost everybody had the runs. But I did, in fact, cop dysentery rather badly, and I, in fact, lost 2 stone. strange. At that time, I was a 10 stone 7 weakling. And when I came out of hospital, I was just over 8 stone. So I'd lost a lot. But it didn't stop them sending me back.
What was your height?
5'9".
And then what are your next memories?
The next movement was, we were then, well, there was all this talk then, of course, about the Second Front, you see. And there were all sorts of rumours, oh, we're going back to Blighty to take part in the Second Front. So we get on the train and we go up to Alexandria and we get on a boat. And we start sailing up the Med, and they said, are we going to turn right and go to Italy, or are we going straight out? We turned right and went back to Italy. And we landed at Taranto. And then we entrained and went across to the west coast of Italy, south of Rome, to a place called Tivoli. When we were told that His Majesty King George V is coming out to inspect the troops, and you will all line the road and give him 3 huzzas as he goes by, which we did.
George VI.
And we, George VI, yeah. Shepherd died of cancer. Yeah, what did I say?
You said George V.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking of that because I had my father's medals remounted recently, and of course it's George VI, yeah. Yes, and he came by standing on the jeep, and the thing that struck us about him, he wore makeup. Now, we, of course, now know that he was suffering from cancer, but he was so pale that he had rouge on his cheeks. And of course, this shocked us. Look at the king, you know. And that was that. And then almost immediately, we were transferred over to the 8th Army to start the assault on the Gothic line, or start to work our way up towards the Gothic line, which we did piece by piece, until we got to the River Senio, which was around about Christmas 1944 then, we're talking about, where we were stagnant on the banks of this Senio for 3 months in Arctic conditions. In fact, when we used to go forward